Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is the 48th episode of the Divine Intervention Podcast, and we're going to continue reviewing material for the neurology shelf. Neuro is a relatively large subject, but I'm trying to break these up as well. But in today's podcast, fair warning, there's going to be a lot of hairy stuff that's high yield, but classically difficult for people to understand. So I will probably try to take my time here, but I'll try to be as quick as possible as well. So let's begin. So the first question says a 32-year-old Asian male presents with severe right eye pain. Physical exam reveals a rock-hard, unreactive pupil. So the question asks for the diagnosis, right? So this is obviously acute angle closure glaucoma, okay? And I mean, you can diagnose this with like tonometry. And in general, the way you treat this is ultimately you require some kind of surgery. And usually it's a laser iridotomy. But if that's not an answer choice and they're asking for drugs you could use, you could give like mannitol to decrease intraocular pressure. You could give acetazolamide, that works as well. You can give a muscarinic agonist like pilocarpine, right? So if you remember from an earlier podcast, if you give pilocarpine is a muscarinic receptor agonist. So that will constrict the pupil, right? And that will relieve pressure around the canals of Schlemm, okay? Alternatively, you could also give like a beta blocker like timolol, okay? But yeah, like timolol, acetazolamide, mannitol, pilocarpine, you probably want to do surgery, laser iridotomy, and you can make the diagnosis with tonometry. Okay, good. So, next question. A 3-year-old female is brought to the ED by her dad. She has been using the potty continuously for the last 3 hours. Physical exam is notable for pupillary meiosis and profuse sweating. She played in the farm, ding, 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 this morning. What's your diagnosis, right? So this is clearly organophosphate poisoning, right? This patient is leaky from everywhere. So this is a cholinergic toxidrome. And because remember, your parasympathetic system, right, makes you pee, makes you poop, makes you sweat and all that stuff. Although your sweat glands are technically controlled by your sympathetic nervous system, but they use acetylcholine as the neurotransmitter to mediate that that effect. Okay, so this patient is leaky from everywhere. This is organophosphate poisoning, right? And for organophosphate poisoning, there's two things you want to do, right? But first off, what do organophosphates do? Organophosphates, right, they inhibit acetylcholinesterase. And if you inhibit acetylcholinesterase, right, your levels of acetylcholine will build up because you're no longer breaking down acetylcholine, okay? So this is organophosphate poisoning. So obviously, if there's too much acetylcholine causing this problem, you want to probably block acetylcholine receptors, right? So that's what atropine will do for you. You can give atropine. Atropine will block the acetylcholine receptors and sort of like ameliorate many of those procholinergic effects that are causing the clinical presentation. And then if you want to regenerate the acetylcholinesterase, you want to use prilidoxime, okay? In the hospital, I believe it's known as 2-PAM, okay? Prilidoxime regenerates the acetylcholinesterase. So again, organophosphate poisoning, give atropine plus prilidoxime. Now, flaccid paralysis after consuming home canned goods, right? That's botulism, right? So this person has a flaccid paralysis, not a spastic paralysis. A spastic paralysis is associated with Clostridium tetani, but a flaccid paralysis is associated with Clostridium botulinum. Remember, the botulinum toxin prevents the release of acetylcholine at the neuromuscular junction. Next one, difficulty getting out of a chair in a patient with a 45-pack-year smoking history that improves with muscle use, right? So hopefully you see this to be Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome, right? So Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome is not the same thing as myasthenia gravis, okay? Myasthenia gravis worsens with use. Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome gets better with use, okay? And remember, the pathophysiology behind LEMS is that you have the formation of autoantibodies against the presynaptic voltage-gated calcium channel. Okay, and that's a classic finding in a patient with small cell lung cancer, right? So it could arise as a paraneoplastic phenomenon. Now, and one thing you may see on a neuro shelf is that I told you that myasthenia gravis gets worse with use. Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome gets better with use. One way they could present that to you in an answer choice is they could say, oh, the patient has increasing muscle contractility with repetitive nerve stimulation. If you see that the muscles are contracting better with repetitive nerve stimulation, think about Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome. But if you're thinking about a decrement in muscle contraction with repetitive nerve stimulation, think more about myasthenia gravis. Next question says, difficulty swallowing and droopy eyelids in a 35-year-old female with an anterior mediastinal mass, right? So again, obviously, this is myasthenia gravis. The anterior mediastinal mass is likely what? a thymoma, right? Remember, thymomas have an association with myasthenia gravis. And just while we're on the subject, anterior mediastinal masses, right? Those are your terrible T's, like a thymoma or a teratoma, okay? A lymphoma could also be an anterior mediastinal mass. Contrast that with the posterior mediastinum that tends to have mostly neural tumors, like a neuroblastoma or a paraganglioma, right? Or if a pheochromocytoma was to show up in the mediastinum, it'll be in the posterior mediastinum, okay? Very high yield to know that. If you're interested more in why that's a thing, I would encourage you to look up the organs of Zucker-Kandel, but I don't have the time to talk about those right now. Okay. And again, myasthenia gravis, you're making autoantibodies against the nicotinic acetylcholine receptor, okay? So those antibodies serve as competitive inhibitors of those receptors. So the thing you do to fix that problem is you give an acetylcholinesterase inhibitor, like pyridostigmine. Remember, pyridostigmine helps you get rid of myasthenia. So pyridostigmine will inhibit acetylcholinesterase. When you do that, that will boost your levels of acetylcholine, and that can outcompete those nasty antibodies that are attached to the nicotinic acetylcholine receptor, and that could fix the problem. And if the patient has the anterior mediastinal mass, the thymoma, you should also get rid of that mass. Okay, you should get rid of that mass. Very high yield to know that. And they may give you a non-specific question where, like, a patient has, like, myasthenia gravis, like, you know from the clinical presentation that it's myasthenia gravis, and then they could say, oh, in addition to treatment with pyridostigmine, what is the next best step in the management of this patient? And the right answer may be to get, like, a chest CT or a chest X-ray, because you just want to screen them for a thymoma, right? Because if they have a thymoma that's causing their problems, you get rid of the thymoma, problem goes away. So sort of watch out for that nondescript scenario on an exam. Now, how do you distinguish myasthenia gravis from CHAT's deficiency? So some of you may not know what CHAT is, right? So the thing is, CHAT is choline acetyltransferase, right? It's basically the rate-limiting enzyme in acetylcholine synthesis. It combines choline and acetyl-CoA to make acetylcholine, okay? So the thing is, a CHAT's deficiency can actually cause like a congenital myasthenic issue, right? So the phenotype, or I guess the clinical presentation, will be the same as myasthenia gravis, but the way you will differentiate between them is based on the response to tensilin, right? Tensilin is edrofonium. Edrofonium is a super short-acting acetylcholinesterase inhibitor, right? So the thing is, think about it. If a patient has myasthenia gravis, you give them edrofonium, you inhibit acetylcholinesterase, the acetylcholine levels go up, right? That will go, that acetylcholine will outcompete the nasty antibodies, and their problem is fixed. Note that in myasthenia gravis, these people have no issue making acetylcholine. They're making acetylcholine just fine, but there is something taking the place of acetylcholine on a nicotinic acetylcholine receptor. Now, if a patient has a CHAT deficiency, they're not making acetylcholine at all, right? So even if you gave those people edrofonium, which is an acetylcholinesterase inhibitor, you will not boost their levels of acetylcholine, right? Because there's no acetylcholine being made in the first place. So failure, I guess the way I'll put it is, if your symptoms improve with the administration of edrofonium, you're thinking about myasthenia gravis. If your symptoms do not improve with the administration of edrofonium, that argues against myasthenia gravis as a diagnosis. That is more likely a CHAT deficiency or choline acetyltransferase deficiency. Although the diagnostic test these days for myasthenia gravis is just to check for acetylcholine receptor antibodies, okay? So no one really does the tensilin test anymore. Now, the neuromuscular junction, right? The pathologies, I've basically highlighted all of them. I've highlighted Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome, where you make autoantibodies against the presynaptic voltage gated calcium channel, okay? Gets better with use, okay? You have increasing muscle contraction with repetitive nerve stimulation. And don't forget the association with small cell lung cancer. And then myasthenia gravis, autoantibodies against nicotinic acetylcholine receptor. You can do a thymectomy to get rid of the thymoma, or you can also give a pyridostigmine to get rid of myasthenia gravis. And then I talked about CHAT deficiency, and then I talked about botulism, right? You're no longer by cleaving snare proteins, right? So that's more throwback to step one. You're not letting vesicles that have acetylcholine in them release that acetylcholine at the level of the neuromuscular junction. So you get a flaccid paralysis, okay? Versus tetanus, where you the tetanospasm, right? It prevents the release of glycine and GABA at the neuromuscular junction, right? And sorry, not at the neuromuscular junction, right? So you prevent the release of glycine and GABA from rhentia cells. And if you don't release those inhibitory neurotransmitters, your muscles will stay like tonically contracted, if you may. Okay, so you have a spastic paralysis in tetanus versus the flaccid paralysis that accompanies botulism. And again, I've talked about the pharmacology for myasthenia gravis, for example, right? You give an acetylcholinesterase inhibitor, that will boost your levels of acetylcholine, you outcompete those nasty antibodies. I also talked about organophosphate poisoning. Again, you give an acetylcholinesterase, you give a muscarinic receptor blocker like atropine, okay? And then you also give something that will regenerate the acetylcholinesterase like pralidoxime. And then for botulism, generally you give like botulinum immune globulin to bind up the toxin, okay? And then you may need to like intubate the patient to give them like respiratory support, okay? And if a patient has like an acetylcholine like deficiency, right? So in the first part, like the kid playing in the farm, that was organophosphate poisoning, that was a procholinergic toxidrome, right? An anticholinergic toxidrome, classically on exams, that will arise with like drugs that have anticholinergic activity, like a diphenhydramine, right? It's a powerful antihistamine, but it's very good at blocking muscarinic receptors. Another classic one on exams is a tricyclic antidepressant. Okay, remember, TCAs have anti-HAM side effects, right? So they have antihistaminergic, so they can cause sedation, anti-alpha-1 effect, so they can cause orthostatic hypotension, and then they also have anti-muscarinic effects, okay? So they can cause like an anticholinergic toxidrome. Another classic group that causes the same thing are your first generation, low potency, typical antipsychotics, okay? Like clopromazine, for example, okay? Has very significant anti-HAM side effects, right? So the MDES stands for anti-muscarinic effects, okay? Very high yield to know those. So the person will be like hot as a hair, dry as a bat, or whatever it's called. But you know what I'm talking about. I believe I've talked about it in a previous podcast. Okay, so next slide. Yeah, that was a long one. So thong fasciculations in a six-month-old, right? So hopefully you know this to be what? I've mentioned this in at least one or two previous podcasts, right? This is spinal muscular atrophy, okay? So they'll describe a kid, 6 months, starts losing motor milestones. That's spinal muscular atrophy. Remember, it's inherited in an autosomal recessive fashion, okay? And the pathophysiology involves having a mutation in the survival motor neuron 1 gene, okay, on chromosome 5. So your lower motor neurons are affected. It's a pure lower motor neuron disease. Okay, don't forget that the West Nile virus and the poliovirus also preferentially nuke your anterior horn cells, right? So your lower motor neurons. Okay, now tongue fasciculations in a 65-year-old male with asymmetric weakness, right? So I really hope you're thinking about ALS, okay, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease, okay? ALS, it's characterized, right, by like upper and lower motor neuron problems, right? And really, like, if they want to go after neuroanatomy on your test, they could ask you like, what are the specific structures that are destroyed that lead to the clinical presentation of ALS? The things that are destroyed are three, okay? You destroy your upper motor neuron, so that's your corticospinal tract. You destroy your lower motor neurons, that's the anterior horn of your spinal cord. Okay, and please do not forget that your cranial nerves are also lower motor neurons, at least some of them. Okay, so at least the ones that are motor cranial nerves. Okay, your cranial nerves are actually lower motor neurons. The upper motor neurons that correspond to your cranial nerves are what constitute the corticobulbar tract. There is such a thing as the corticospinal tract, which controls the lower motor neurons that constitute the anterior horn of your spinal cord. But the upper motor neurons that actually correlate with the lower motor neurons that are your cranial nerves, is at least your motor cranial nerves, that's actually the corticobulbar tract. It's a concept that's not often discussed, but it's actually kind of high yield to know if you really think about it. And then the third thing three things: corticospinal tract, cranial nerves, because they're also lower motor neurons, at least your motor cranial nerves, and also the anterior horn of the spinal cord, right? And familial ALS, right? Hopefully you remember like a superoxide dismutase 1 mutation, an SOD1 mutation, okay? There's another one that may show up out of the blue on an exam, so I'll just mention it. It's C9ORF72. It's just one of those things where you're like, Divine, come on, there's no way this will show up on a test. Well, think again, okay? Just sort of file that somewhere in your mind. C9 or RF72. But the most common one you'll see on exams is an SOD1, a superoxide dismutase 1 mutation, okay? And remember, sensation is spared in ALS. Sensation is spared. And ALS on exams generally does not involve extraocular muscles, okay? It does not involve extraocular muscles, and there is almost never bowel or bladder dysfunction in ALS on MBMEs. So you want to keep those facts at the back of your mind. And the thing is, many times on MBMEs, they may give you an answer that describes an EMG finding. The thing is, I mean, like, to read EMGs, you probably need to complete like some kind of neurology fellowship, right? So obviously we can't do that, right? So there are certain buzzwords I'm going to say out loud that I think you should remember for ALS. They love to test those weird things, right? So the buzzwords you want to remember on EMG for ALS is that you'll see chronic denervation, and like evidence of chronic denervation and innervation, or you may see a buzzword that says like fibrillation potentials. Okay, if you see those buzzwords, think about ALS, right? I already talked about a buzzword for myasthenia gravis, decremental muscle response with repetitive nerve stimulation, right? Or for what is this other thing I just talked about? For Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome, right, you have an incremental, not decremental. Decremental is like a decrease. That's myasthenia gravis. Incremental is an increase, right? That's Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome, an incremental response with repetitive nerve stimulation. Think more about a Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome, okay? And the thing is, there's actually only been two things that have been shown to improve survival in ALS, okay? One is riluzole. Remember, riluzole is used to treat Lou Gehrig's disease, okay? Riluzole is an NMDA receptor antagonist. So they think that by blocking NMDA receptors, it sort of shuts down that whole concept we throw around in medicine of a glutamate excitotoxicity so that you don't destroy the neurons that are nuked in ALS. The other intervention that has actually been shown to improve survival is the use of BiPAP, okay? So that's just something you want to keep at the back of your mind. And then an off... like, this is a rarely tested factoid, but I'll just throw this in there. If a patient has ALS and they have spasticity, or they have like MS, like multiple sclerosis, and they have spasticity, or they have a cerebral palsy and they have spasticity, you could give them baclofen. Baclofen is a GABA B receptor agonist, okay? So it sort of calms down the spasticity. Alternatively, if it's like a focal spasticity, right? So like if a patient has like a focal dystonia or something like that, you can inject Botox and calm down those muscles, because those muscles will stop contracting because you're no longer releasing acetylcholine at the neuromuscular junction. Another weird drug you may see on an exam is tizanidine. Tizanidine sounds eerily similar to clonidine, right? So it's an alpha 2 agonist. It decreases the release of norepinephrine, and that actually reduces spasticity in ALS as well, or any other kind of hyperspasticity disorder. Okay, so next question says, differentiating dermato from polymyositis, right? So age demographic, cell type mediating muscle destruction, histologic findings, right? And then I'm asking for the classic presentation. I'm asking for the associated autoantibodies, right? And then I'm asking about the stepwise diagnostic testing and the treatment. And then associated malignancy. So that's a lot of questions. So let me just sort of deal with all of them all at once. Okay. So the thing is, if I were you, if you're listening to this podcast right now, I would make a chart. Okay. I actually also talked about these differences in the medicine review video. So the thing is, dermatomyositis, right, occurs in kids. Okay. Polymyositis occurs generally in adults on exams. That's one difference. Second one. Dermatomyositis is mediated by CD4 positive B cells. CD4 positive T cells. Polymyositis is mediated by CD8 positive T cells. So here's the thing. You may say, oh, Divine, come on, this is kind of hard to remember. Let me just give you a trick that I use. But the thing is, it does not work in one instance. So you need to memorize that other one instance. But the thing is, if you notice, if you're looking at the alphabet, D comes before P in the alphabet. So dermatomyositis comes before polymyositis in the alphabet, okay? So that's like the strategy, like what comes before what, logically. Now, next thing, notice I said dermatomyositis is more common in kids, Polymyositis is quite common in adults, right? So before you become an adult, you're a kid first, okay? Don't take this to mean that dermatomyositis does not occur in adults. In fact, the most common person that gets dermatomyositis on exams is an adult, okay? But dermatomyositis is quite common in kids. Polymyositis is quite common in adults, okay? So that's a high yield thing to know. Now, third thing, notice 4 comes before 8 if you're looking at the number line, right? So CD4 positive for dermatomyositis, CD8 positive for polymyositis, okay? And those are T cells. And then don't forget that you have, so this is the one instance you need to memorize where that does not work. You have perifascicular damage or inflammation in dermatomyositis, and you have endomysial damage in polymyositis. So it's like, P actually comes after E in the alphabet, okay? So that's just another weird thing you sort of have to like store in your brain. Okay, and the associated autoantibodies, right? There's like anti-JO1, anti-MI2, they have like weird names. There's another weird one. It's called like anti-signal recognition particle. So anti-SRP. For those of you that hopefully studied for step one in the past, right? The signal recognition particle is what sneaks in an incompletely synthesized protein to the endoplasmic reticulum when it's been made on a bound ribosome. Remember, a bound ribosome is one that is attached to the endoplasmic reticulum. But that's step one further. I'm not going to go there any further. If you have any questions on that, just send me a message or something. Okay. Now, the thing is, before, the diagnostic test for polymyositis, dermatomyositis was to do a muscle biopsy, but that is no longer the first line diagnostic test, okay? The first line diagnostic test for, I mean, obviously you'll check the creatine kinase, you'll be high, well, big surprise. The first line diagnostic test these days for poly or dermatomyositis is actually to do a muscle MRI, okay? Many times you can make the diagnosis just by doing an MRI, but if the MRI does not show you what you're looking for, then you can proceed to doing some kind of muscle biopsy, okay? And usually they also do some kind of imaging with that as well. And don't forget that polymyositis, dermatomyositis, they may actually show up as paraneoplastic phenomena in the setting of lung cancer, okay? Especially like small cell lung cancer. So that's one thing you want to keep at the back of your mind. So one weird thing I just decided to throw in here, because I can easily see them putting this on a test and like essentially everyone will get it wrong, but you won't get it wrong because you're listening to this podcast, is if they give you the combination of dysarthria, truncal, gait, and limb ataxia in a patient that is subsequently found to have lung cancer. So the thing is this, if you're thinking like ataxia, limb ataxia, dysarthria, right, that sort of localizes to the cerebellum. Right? And the thing is, if I'm giving you a question in the context of lung cancer, I'm really, really hoping that you're thinking about a paraneoplastic phenomenon. Okay? The paraneoplastic phenomenon I'm actually going after here is something known as a paraneoplastic cerebellar degeneration. Okay? Paraneoplastic cerebellar degeneration has a very strong association with lung cancer, but it also has a pretty solid association with breast cancer as well. Okay, so the underlying pathophysiology, I mean, people are not exactly sure, but what I've read in the literature is that these tumors express cerebellar proteins, and then when the tumors express cerebellar proteins, the anti-tumor response that your immune system mounts, right, against those cerebellar proteins ends up like as an off-target effect, destroying the cerebellum. Okay, so the phenomenon is known as paraneoplastic cerebellar degeneration. And it's actually kind of high yield to know that there are two classic autoantibodies associated with paraneoplastic cerebellar degeneration. They're known as anti-HU, so anti-HU, and anti-YO. So that's like anti-YO, okay? So anti-HU and anti-YO antibodies. Very high yield to know that. It's just one of these things I can sort of like feel in my veins that it may show up on an exam in the future. If I'm not mistaken, I mean, I've actually seen this tested already. Okay. So that is, let me see, is there any other thing I want to cover on this slide? No, that's it. So let's move on to the next one. So confusion of thermoplegia and ataxia in an alcoholic, right? So this is Wernicke's, right? And then what's the diagnosis if you added forgetfulness to the picture or making stuff up to the picture, right? That's a confabulation. That's Korsakoff psychosis, right? So it's along a spectrum. Wernicke's is reversible. Korsakoff psychosis is not reversible, okay? And in general, the way you treat these problems is with IV thiamine, vitamin B1, right? Because remember, they think that, oh, people that have Wernicke's, they have problems with the transketolase. That's one of the big enzymes in the non-oxidative phase of the hexose monophosphate shunt, which I believe is also known as the pentose phosphate pathway. And then, I didn't really see any place to throw this in, so I decided to put this here. How do you manage hepatic encephalopathy, right? The thing is, hepatic encephalopathy, there's a couple of things you could do, right? So you can give lactulose, right? It'll convert ammonia in the gut to ammonium, so you pop out the ammonia that way because ammonium is not reabsorbed, at least for the most part. And then you could also give antibiotics, right? Because remember, a lot of ammonia in the body actually comes from the bacteria in your GI tract. So you can just kill them. I know that sounds kind of morbid. You just kill all of them, and you can kill them with a bunch of drugs. If you see this drug on your exam, go with this drug first, rifaximin. Rifaximin is actually a preferred agent for killing off GI flora, okay, because it has very few side effects. But other drugs you may see on an exam is like neomycin. Remember, neomycin is an aminoglycoside. Those are your 30S bactericidal agents. You could also give vancomycin, or like oral vancomycin, because remember, oral vancomycin is not reabsorbed, right? So it stays in the GI tract and kills off everything. Alternatively, you could also give metronidazole. But the problem with metronidazole is in patients with hepatic encephalopathy, there's been a lot of studies that show that they tend to get peripheral neuropathies when they take metronidazole, okay? So think more about lactulose rifaximin, okay? In fact, I'll tell you this. Let's assume you got like the most evil question in the world where they put lactulose and rifaximin as answer choices. Go with rifaximin. Rifaximin is, if I'm not mistaken, the first line medication these days for the treatment of hepatic encephalopathy. Okay, so next question. Simple partial seizures, right? So there is no loss of consciousness with simple partial seizures. And now, classic presentation with respect to localizing principles, right? And then I'll sort of talk about the different simple partial seizure types. Okay, so again, this is high yield. This is one of those things you can almost guarantee you'll potentially see on an exam. So the thing is, a simple partial seizure, right? It's essentially a focal seizure, okay? And you don't lose awareness. You don't lose consciousness with a simple partial seizure. And the thing is, there are four kinds of simple partial seizures, right? There's like a motor seizure. There's like a motor simple partial seizure. There's the sensory kind. There's the autonomic kind. There's the psychic kind, right? And the thing is, I will just encourage you to sort of pay attention to these buzz phrases that I'm going to reel out over the next minute. So the thing is, the motor seizures, right, those ones tend to present as like a focal, like rigidity or jerking of an extremity, right? So they can just say, oh, patient suddenly feels that one hand is like very stiff and very rigid. If you see that, I really want you to think about a motor simple partial seizure. And another name for a simple partial seizure, like I said earlier, is a focal seizure without loss of awareness. Okay, so if they tell you that the patient has focal muscle rigidity or like jerking of one extremity, that's most likely a motor simple partial seizure. And then a sensory one, they may describe like a patient saying that they hear like a hissing sound. So basically like weird sensations, right? Like they can't see during the seizure episode, or they can't hear, or they hear like a hissing sound, or they smell like burnt rubber, or stuff tastes weird to them, or they feel like weird touches on their face. Think about a sensory kind of simple partial seizure. For the autonomic kind, you want to think more about like they may say like, oh, they sweat during the episodes, or they have like mydriasis during the episodes, or they have like a rising sensation in their abdomen during the episode, right? Those are more autonomic issues. And then the psychic kind, that's the one where there's almost always no real symptom there. So that one I will say is probably, you'll probably never see it on an exam. Okay, and the thing is localization. So the thing is, your homunculus is actually pretty helpful here. So if, for example, a patient has like focal sensory or motor problems, right? You can basically localize that to like the contralateral, like frontal or parietal lobe. Okay, but if they tell you that the patient has like auras and it's like a simple partial seizure, like auras of fear, or they say like they have like they're smelling weird stuff, or they're hearing weird stuff like a hissing sound, or like a deja vu experience where they're like, this thing looks like something that has happened to me before, or they have like a rising sensation in the abdomen, think more about the temporal lobe. Just think of the temporal lobe as being associated with weirdness. Okay, so that is all I believe I'm going to say with respect to simple partial seizures. So next slide. The next slide says required imaging before recommending sports in a patient in a 12-year-old with a history of trisomy 21. This concept, I must tell you, is like ridiculously high yield for exams. Like you, like this can essentially be tested on any shelf exam, even psychiatry. Very high yield to know this. The thing is, this child, you want to go ahead and do a lateral neck X-ray because you're trying to rule out something known as atlanto-axial instability. Okay, atlanto-axial instability. You don't want to have them like have spinal cord injury because you didn't do a lateral neck X-ray. Okay, so atlanto-axial like subluxation or instability has a very strong association with Down's syndrome. Now, there are some other high yield disorders that have that association, right? So rheumatoid arthritis, the classic way they'll test that is they'll talk about a patient with RA that is about to get surgery, right, that requires intubation. Before you intubate a patient with RA, if they've not done that study before, make sure they get a lateral neck X-ray to rule out atlanto-axial subluxation. And then the last group is a patient with a history of ankylosing spondylitis. Again, you want to rule out atlanto-axial subluxation with this. I promise you, like, over the next year, if you're like a third-year med student, you'll see this concept tested about 15 times. And they always put it as a nondescript question, so people get it wrong. And also, a lateral neck X-ray, I'll also say this is probably more for a surgery shelf, is indicated for a patient that's that like a trauma patient where you're trying to rule out C-spine injury, okay? Choose a lateral neck X-ray as against the CT scan. The thing is, in the real world, everybody does a CAT scan because it gives you better, like better pictures, right? But on MBMEs, a lateral neck X-ray until they make changes, at least in my experience, is what is correct for ruling out C-spine injury. Okay, good. Next question. So next question says, 25-year-old male goes into respiratory failure. He recently recovered from a 7-day episode of bloody diarrhea. Ding, ding, ding. Physical exam is notable for pronounced areflexia in the lower extremities bilaterally. His parents report that he had muscle weakness that started in the legs and progressed upwards. Okay. Symmetric ascending flaccid paralysis. Okay. He initially complained of leg tingling and numbness before his other symptoms started. What is your diagnosis? And this patient recently had bloody diarrhea. Well, I really hope you're thinking about GBS. Guillain-Barré syndrome. Okay, remember, it's an autoimmune disease that affects myelin proteins, right? It's like a peripheral demyelinating disease, if you may. Okay, so the cells that are affected, right, in this case will not be oligodendrocytes. The cells that we affected will be your Schwann cells, right, because those are the things that myelinate axons in the peripheral nervous system. Okay, I remember one Schwann cell myelinates one axon versus an oligodendrocyte, like a single oligodendrocyte myelinating multiple axons, okay? And classically on exams, right, it's preceded by like a viral or like a bacterial infection of some sort, okay? But classically on tests, think about bloody diarrhea from Campylobacter jejuni. Very high yield to know that. And the classic CSF findings, right, in Guillain-Barré syndrome, right, I've talked about this in a prior neuro podcast, is this thing known as albuminocytologic dissociation, right? Because remember, when I talked about I had like a meningitis spiel in one of the podcasts, I said that if the white cell count in your CSF is high on a lumbar puncture, usually your white cell, usually the protein, like the proteins, if you measure the protein in the CSF will also be high, right? So there is an agreement between the amount of protein being high and the amount of white cells being high, okay? So you have like, let me invent a word. Like you have agreement. You have like albuminocytologic agreement, if you may. That's the normal situation. But in Guillain-Barré syndrome, you classically see a very high protein count in the CSF. But you check the number of white cells and they're almost non-existent. Okay? There is no agreement between those two. That is why the buzzword is known as albuminocytologic dissociation. Very high yield to know that. And the thing is, on exams, here's one way they can mess with your head. Instead of putting Guillain-Barré syndrome as an answer choice, they may put this term, AIDP. AIDP stands for acute inflammatory demyelinating polyneuropathy. Okay? That's one way they, like, AIDP, like, basically it's Guillain-Barré syndrome. That's just a fancy schmancy name for Guillain-Barré syndrome. So just sort of keep that in the back of your mind. And really the way you treat this is with, you can do like plasmapheresis, or you can do IVIG. IVIG is probably the preferred answer on exams, okay? And then weird association at the bottom, because your neurologists, they love their trivia, right? Just like the radiology people as well. But basically, if they tell you that a patient has like a Guillain-Barré-like presentation, but they also tell you that the patient has nystagmus and ataxia, I want you to think about Miller-Fisher syndrome, okay? Miller-Fisher syndrome. That's all I'm going to say about that. It's just something you want to be able to recognize on a test. And then the next question says pathophysiology of the subclavian steel syndrome. And I'll talk about the classic exam presentation. And then I have a slide where I try to like draw out something to sort of make the point clear. Okay, so let's talk about subclavian steel syndrome, right? So basically, they'll describe a patient that when they use their arms, they have like syncope or like neurologic deficits, or they have like a blood pressure differential in the arms, okay? Think about subclavian steel syndrome. So I'll encourage you to jump to the next slide. Let's talk about the pathophysiology real quick. So the thing is, the sort of like the inciting event for subclavian steel syndrome, so triple S, so I'll just call it SSS. So the inciting event for SSS is that usually what happens is you have like some kind of proximal subclavian stenosis, okay? But remember that the subclavian artery has many branches, right? Like the vertebral arteries, for example. So the thing is, if you have a proximal subclavian stenosis, right, there'll be less blood flow prior to that stenosis. So it's like you essentially have like more blood flowing on the opposite side that does not have the subclavian stenosis. So in this diagram, for example, if you take a quick look at this, you'll see that the stenosis, the proximal subclavian stenosis, is on the left side. So you have increased blood flow in the right vertebral artery. Okay, so increased blood flow in the right subclavian, so you have increased blood flow in the right vertebral. Okay, so it's like blood flows, boom, 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 right vertebral, and then it approaches the basilar artery. Okay, but if you look at the diagram, which is actually somewhat realistic, although I know I'm not the best at art, but you get the point. The basilar artery and the vertebral arteries bilaterally is actually kind of like a closed loop system. And the thing is, distal to the stenosis of the left subclavian, right, you're basically creating like a low pressure system, right? Because if you compare the vertebral artery and the subclavian artery, in this case, the distal subclavian artery, the distal subclavian artery is longer than the vertebral artery, and the distal subclavian artery is wider than the vertebral artery. If you're thinking about Poiseuille's law, I'll encourage you to go back and do like your cardiology research. Although I think I actually talked about this in one of the first podcasts I ever made. It's probably like episode 4 or something like that. But basically, according to Poiseuille's law, right, the left subclavian artery is wider, right? So because the radius is bigger, the resistance there is lower. Okay, so relative to the left vertebral, the left subclavian, at least the left distal subclavian, so distal to the stenosis, has lower pressures. So that actually creates like a suction-like effect that draws blood from the vertebral arteries. Okay, so you're basically stealing blood that could have gone up the basilar artery, and you're stealing it to the subclavian artery on the side with the stenosis, especially when you use that ipsilateral upper extremity, because you're calling on more oxygen and nutrients, okay? So that's why it's called the subclavian steel syndrome. So I really hope this gives you like an idea as to what's going on. And the vertebral basilar problems they get, right, is again, because you're hypoperfusing the brainstem, because not enough blood is flowing in the basilar artery. And then the last thing I'll just say, this just came to mind. There's this weird thing known as Paget-Schroeder disease, okay? Basically, it's like thrombosis that occurs in an upper extremity vein if a patient uses that upper extremity like a ton, like if the patient is like a jackhammer or a weightlifter or something, okay? It's just one of those weird things you want to like file away in your mind for the future. It may show up on an exam you see. Okay, so let's jump to the next slide. Okay, so this is the really hairy part of this presentation. In fact, I'm not making this a question. I'm just going to explain, okay? And the thing is, I'm going to explain this in two different ways, just to make sure that I really get the point home. So the Weber and Rennie tests, okay? The Weber and Rennie tests. So the thing is, these tests, they are quite annoying to learn, actually. Okay, so I'm going to try to simplify them for you. The thing is, I think the first thing we should try to establish is knowing what the Weber test does and what the Rinne test does. Okay, the thing is, the purpose of the Weber test, or if you're German, I guess you could call it Weber, but whatever. So the Weber test, it basically compares bone conduction in both ears. Okay, so it's a test of both ears. It compares bone conduction in both ears. The Rinne test, what it does is it compares air conduction to bone conduction for each ear. So the Weber test is a double ear test. The Rinne test is a single ear test. Okay, the Rinne test compares air conduction to bone conduction in each ear. Okay, now one big thing you want to realize is that none of these tests can be performed in isolation. Okay, you need to do both pretty much at the same time to be able to localize the exact kind of hearing loss. And the thing is, I mean, there are a couple of approaches you could take with this, right? You could just memorize a chart. It's probably an easy thing to do, but the thing is, on exams, you're very good at writing the questions in like weird ways where like all those patterns you sort of like, at least the stuff you memorize like word for word may just sort of fall apart, okay? And the thing is, almost always people forget the chart they've memorized. So just actually try to understand it. If you understand it, then you can sort of reason through whatever scenario is thrown in front of you on an exam. So let's go to the next slide. So let's talk about some rules. I'll talk about it in words, and then I'll talk about it in an algorithm, just to, again, press this point home. So the thing is, under normal circumstances, air conduction is better than bone conduction, okay? Air conduction is better than bone conduction, right? And again, that should make some sense, because before you hear something in your brain, right, it has to go through your outer ear first, so that's like the conduction part of things, right? And then it then has to go through your cochlea. That is like the sensation part of things, like the sensory neural part of things. So think of air conduction as dealing with conductive hearing and bone conduction as dealing with sensory neural hearing. Okay, so air conduction is better than bone conduction. That is the normal circumstance. Now, when bone conduction is better than air conduction in a given ear, okay, so this is another rule you want to keep in mind. When bone conduction is better than air conduction, that is abnormal. Okay, but that just means that things sound louder in that ear. Okay, things sound louder in that ear. And the truth is, no one really knows why this is the case, at least from all the like literature reviewing that I have done. But people think that, oh, it may relate to having increased hair cell sensitivity in the ear that has bone conduction being better than air conduction. Okay, but the thing is, if something sounds louder in an ear, right, and bone conduction is better than air conduction, it means that that singular ear has an issue with the conductive component of hearing, okay? Because that means the air conduction has been knocked out in some way, shape, or form, okay? So the Weber test, again, helps you compare bone conduction in both ears, okay? Again, normally bone conduction in both ears should be the same. Okay, things should sound the same in both ears. That's why my students say, oh, they put one their hand by your ear to test cranial nerve 8. Do you hear this? Do you hear this? Do they sound similar? You say yes. I mean, it's not a Weber test exactly, but this sort of testing cranial 8 function. Things should sound the same in both ears. Okay, so, but if things sound louder in one ear compared to the other, so let's say like things sound louder in ear A. The other ear will be ear B. Okay, so just kind of stick with me here. This is where things get a little hairy. If things sound louder in one ear, so let's say, oh, things are sounding louder in ear A, based on your Weber test, there's something bad going on. Okay, now, the thing is, there are two potential explanations for why things are sounding louder in ear A. One explanation could be based on what I already said. It could mean that ear A has a conductive hearing loss problem. Okay, as I mentioned again, like literally in the second paragraph on this slide. Okay, but another thing that may be happening is that ear B, the other ear, may actually have a sensory neural hearing problem. Okay, so that things are sounding softer in ear B relative to ear A. So if things are sounding softer in ear B, then obviously ear A, things will sound a lot louder in ear A compared to ear B. Okay, so again, if you're like, oh, something sounds louder in one ear, there are one of two explanations for it. It's either You have a conductive hearing problem in the ipsilateral ear, that things are sounding louder, or you could have a contralateral sensory neural hearing loss. Because if you have a contralateral sensory neural hearing loss, that contralateral ear, things will sound softer in that ear. And if things sound softer in that ear, then the ipsilateral ear that actually has no problem, that things are sounding louder in, will obviously sound louder relative to the other ear. Okay, so again, let me say this again. If things sound louder in one ear compared to the other on a Weber test, that is not normal. There are two potential explanations. You could either have a conductive hearing loss in the ear where things sound louder, or you could have a contralateral, like a sensorineural neural hearing loss, in the ear that things, in the ear that is contralateral to the ear where things are sounding louder. I know it's very annoying. Neuro can be a very frustrating subject for people, but it's actually kind of fun if you understand what's going on. And again, I will explain this in another fashion. In fact, this is me repeating it again for emphasis. Things could be sounding better in ear A because it has a conductive hearing problem. That's the ipsilateral ear where things are sounding louder. Because again, remember on the previous slide, I said that things sound louder when bone conduction is better than air conduction in a given ear. Okay, so ear B could be totally normal. That is one explanation. The second explanation could be that ear B could have a sensory neural hearing loss. Okay, so ear B could have a, I'm correcting myself, I typed in the wrong thing. Let me just do it right now so I don't forget. So ear B could have a sensorineural neural hearing loss. So things sound softer in this in ear B relative to ear A. Or you can express it another way. Stuff sounds louder in ear A relative to ear B. Okay? So please make sure, like, if you need to pause and rewind, make sure you understand this. It's like, I promise you, it is very important, because most people just give up on this concept and just sort of say, you know what, I'm not going to bother about this. Okay, so please just bear with me and rewind and listen to this again. And again, I will explain this on the next slide, just for emphasis again. So how do we basically determine which of these two potential issues is true? The thing we do is we then do the Rene test. That's why the Rene test is done in association with the Weber test. So the thing you do in the Rene test is you place a sounded tuning fork on the mastoid process, okay, and then you place it just outside the ear. The thing that should happen is that, let me explain the test, right? So sounded tuning fork, you place it on the mastoid process. When the patient says, oh, they've stopped hearing, when you place it on the mastoid process, you're testing bone conduction. When the patient says, oh, doc, I've stopped hearing, you then move that tuning fork to like the outer ear, right? The normal situation is that they should still hear something in the outer ear, because again, I said that the normal situation is that air conduction is better than bone conduction. Now, if from the Rene test, your results are that, air conduction is not as good as bone conduction, then some kind of conductive hearing loss is present. And since we already said from the previous slide that, one of the two scenarios that could create that issue is having conductive hearing loss in the ipsilateral ear, so like ear A, then that means ear A is the lesioned ear, okay? But I think for this last part, probably the next slide where I have the algorithm will help make things make more sense. So let's talk about this real quick. So I made this in one note, so hopefully you see my writing. So the rules, again, normally air conduction is greater than bone conduction, okay? And AC is air conduction, BC is bone conduction, okay? So basically, like, your conductive hearing is better than your sensorineural neural hearing, okay? Next rule is that things should sound the same in both ears. Things should sound the same in both ears. That's the normal situation, okay? So let's say you do the Weber test. Now remember, I said that the Weber test compares bone conduction in two ears, in both ears, okay? If you do the Weber test and things sound louder in one ear, that is abnormal, okay? One of two things are going on. Either you have an ipsilateral conductive hearing loss or a contralateral sensorineural neural hearing loss. And notice in parentheses, I put that things sound softer in the contralateral ear, okay? So that means the normal ear, like things sound relatively louder in that ear. Okay, so to sort those two things out, you do the Rene test. And I say that the Rene test, his job is to compare air conduction and bone conduction in a singular ear. If the air conduction is greater than bone conduction, that is the normal situation. So that means the ear that things are sounding louder in does not have an issue. That will then tell you that you have a contralateral sensory neural hearing loss. But if you do the Rene test and the bone conduction is greater than air conduction, that is what you see with a conductive hearing loss. And we said that one of the two options is having a conductive hearing loss in the ipsilateral ear. So that will be that the ipsilateral ear has a conductive hearing loss. So please make sure you understand this. If you have any questions on this, let me know and I'll be happy to explain this to you. Because this is just something that I think is very understandable. It's confusing at first, but once you get it, you'll be like, wait, why have I suffered so for so many years trying to understand this stuff? Okay, so try to make sure you understand this hearing business. So our last question, and then I'll sign off. Meningitis in a HIV positive patient, right? Hopefully you're thinking about coccidioides immitis, okay? And the way you treat this is with amphoterol, okay? You give amphotericin B plus 5 flucytosine, okay? And then chronically for like a year, you give like fluconazole. And remember that you can identify cryptococcus. Whoops, did I say coccidioides? Whoops, sorry if I said that. Meningitis in an AIDS patient, sorry about that, is a cryptococcus neoformans, okay? And remember, you can ID that with the India ink stain, or you can do like a latex agglutination assay or something, okay? Now, but the treatment is correct. Amphoterol, so amphotericin B, that's the ergosterol binder plus 5-flucytosine, which is converted by cytosine deaminase to 5-FU, which inhibits thymidylate synthase in the bug. And then multiple ring enhancing lesions on MR imaging in a HIV positive patient, right? So your differential is one of two things. It's either a primary CNS lymphoma, which is usually a solitary lesion, or neurocystic sarcosis, which is usually multiple lesions. Okay, so ring enhancing lesions, brain, HIV patient, think about primary CNS lymphoma or neurocystic sarcosis. So how do you treat neurocystic sarcosis? Neurocystic sarcosis, you treat that with sulfadiazine and pyrimethamine, okay? And the way you prophylax against this, right? Why am I seeing weird things today? I'm sorry. I've just sorted through way too much material today. It's not neurocystic sarcosis, it's toxoplasma gondii. And you treat that with pyrimethamine and sulfadiazine. That is correct. I know I'm mixing up these bug names for some reason today. I apologize. So you treat that with pyrimethamine, sulfadiazine. And the thing is, if your CD4 count is less than 100, right, you're supposed to give Bactrim, trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, as prophylaxis against toxoplasmosis. And then for CNS lymphoma, right, classically that's associated with EBV. Okay, but usually the way you diagnose CNS lymphoma is you're like, oh, patient has HIV, they have ring enhancing lesions. Like, okay, well, this is likely toxo, right? And then you give pyrimethamine sulfadiazine. You're like, this person does not appear to be getting better. You're like, okay, that's not good. And then you maybe do like some kind of biopsy and then discover that it's primary CNS lymphoma. Primary CNS lymphoma is not very treatable. Although if you give highly active antiretroviral therapy, that could actually reverse course with that disorder. Sometimes they also give chemo, but I wouldn't worry about the treatment of primary CNS lymphoma. That's really, if ever tested on MBMs, at least at the level I'm discussing. So next question is mini mental. So again, first bug, meningitis HIV patient is crypto. Ring enhancing lesions, HIV patient is toxo, okay? And you prophylax with Bactrim when the CD4 count falls below 100. Now, next question, mini mental status exam is MMSE is 20 over 30 in a patient with a CD4 count of 25 and a high viral load. He last saw his PCP after an initial diagnosis 21 years ago. So this is HIV associated dementia, okay? That's the diagnosis. This is almost terminal. Basically, if you have HIV-associated dementia, these people are probably, they don't have a very good prognosis at that point. But you can try highly active antiretroviral therapy. You can give the drugs that are used for Alzheimer's dementia, like donepezil, galantamine, rivastigmine, or tacrine. But yeah, once you have HIV-associated dementia, that's usually an ominous sign. Okay, and then last question, HIV-positive patient with neurodeficits and multiple areas of demyelination on MR imaging, right? So hopefully you're thinking about the JC virus and progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy, okay? And there's a drug that also has this association. In fact, this drug is used classically in the treatment of multiple sclerosis. That will be natalizumab. Remember, it's like an alpha-4 integrin inhibitor. Okay, so I know this has gone long, but this podcast, I made it specifically because it goes over like hairy concepts that just seem to like make people just be very angry or like bang their heads on the table during a neuro exam. So hopefully you find this helpful. If you have any questions, just reach out. I'll be more than happy to point you in the right direction. So I wish you all the best. If you need tutoring or anything like that, you can reach out to me. Have a wonderful day, and God bless. I'll see you in the next podcast.